The biggest survival factor to me was being able to have an identity outside of law enforcement. The moment that's stripped from you, you kind of stand there and you're confused. You don't know what to do. You feel separated from the community. You feel alone. You feel abandoned. And that takes a huge emotional toll on you. In order for me to survive, I had to separate myself from the career 100%, learn to adapt and live as a civilian while fighting my case.
Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, 2023 at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center. It's going to be a great experience. 5 career-changing days, some of the most profound speakers in the industry. Guest speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Congressional Medal of Honor winner, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Navy SEAL American war hero Jason Redman, Sheriff David Clark, Sheriff Mark Lamb, and Sheriff Wayne Ivey. You'll also spend time with all of our Street Cop instructors at this event Monday through Friday. We'll have a great lineup of courses in addition to our great speakers. It will be a week that you will not forget. You'll be thankful you came. You don't want to miss out. Check out streetcop.com on how to register. If you're going to use the room code, make sure you book it from Sunday through Friday. That's what the code's good for, and it's about half the price of the regular rate. But those rooms are running out, so make sure you sign up now. We'll see you there.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino. You know, I just made that shit up one day, Frank, and just said that. Yeah, just I don't even, there was no like thought put into it. I just said that and I just keep saying it now. That's the thing. All right. We're here today with a guy who has been through the fucking ringer, and we're glad to see him out of the fucking ringer. And I think he's going to bring a lot of value to the law enforcement community. But thank you for being here, dude. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for your command staff for allowing you to come out here and sharing your story. But none other than Yusuf Hafsa. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, I tell people like Jimmy Hoffa, but Hafsa.
What's your background before we start? Like, what's your ethnicity?
Yeah, my parents are both from Beirut, Lebanon. My mom, my
okay,
dad.
So Lebanese.
Yep. I speak
cool, man. Arabic. We have a lot of Lebanese community here in the state of New Jersey. Yep. A lot of Lebanese folks. I have a lot of Lebanese friends. It's super cool, man. I am very familiar with the culture.
Yep. I speak Arabic, you know, first language.
That's awesome, dude. So. Interesting. Were you born in Lebanon or you born here?
No, I was born in Daytona Beach, Florida, and then I was raised in Orlando.
When did your parents come here?
My dad came here, I want to say, in the early 70s, maybe. I mean, he worked in Disney for 43 years.
Wow. What'd your dad do in Disney?
He worked in a restaurant.
No kidding.
Yeah. So you see his photos every 5 years. He's got a plaque. But we grew up in Disney as kids. We used to go with him. He would go in and get his uniforms, and we'd sit in the dressing room and wait. He'd walk us out, and he'd be like, "All right, you guys got to be back by 7. When I get off, and we'd just run all over Disney as kids and come back.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great life, you know, being in Disney. You know,
that's so awesome, man. That
was a great time. Yeah.
All right. So give us a little context of. Let's start out with who you are, how you came into law enforcement. Well, and then we'll go into the details of what brings you here today.
What actually drew me to law enforcement wasn't something that I grew up saying I want to be a cop. It was just one night, I think around 2004, maybe. No, 2002. I was sitting on my porch in Orlando. We had a screen porch. And I saw a car drive in our street. It's a cul-de-sac, so one way in, one way out. Saw a vehicle come in, and he blacked out. And I was sitting on the phone talking, and I watched him actually get out of the car and start walking up to vehicles and driveways and popping open the doors and started going inside. And he was just relaxed, man. He was sitting in the car, pulling stuff out, walking. He did this house to house to house, which ultimately what he was doing, a burglary. So I called, 911, spoke to the dispatcher, and, we had a few minutes on the phone. That went on for a little bit until they set up a perimeter, and he ended up leaving after he burglarized about a dozen cars, and they got in a pursuit, caught him. Well, my first interaction with law enforcement at that point was getting picked up, put in the back of the car, driven to the scene to identify him. And when I got there, I just remember at that young seeing dozens of blue lights everywhere from the pursuit that they had. And all these cops walking up, and as I identified him, they're all high-fiving me. I was still young, They're all high-fiving me saying, "Great job. This guy had burglarized dozens of homes and has been doing this for like a week, not getting captured." So they got a lot of charges on him. And it was from that moment I said, I think this is what I want to do. I did a ride along with the Orange County Sheriff's Office in Orlando, and it stuck with me from there. And I worked my way to the academy. So 2003, I ended up attending the academy. I was 19 or 20 years old at the time. So I was told, you know, more than likely you're not going to get a job. At that time in law enforcement, it was 300 applicants to one job, not like today. So when I applied, the academy actually looked at me and said, hey, man, you're probably not going to get a job. We don't know if we would fill you in. We have one seat left and the chances of you getting in is not high. But there's a scholarship if you don't have money, because I didn't really have money at the time. They said, there's a scholarship. You can fill it out. Your chances are probably zero. That was told that. So I filled out the scholarship, put everything into it, passionate about it. And I was convinced I'm going to get into the academy. Filled it out. They called me back and they were shocked. They're like, the scholarship, you know, they accepted you to the academy. So you're getting paid full to go to the academy. So I got that 2003, got on and graduated in the academy. And it wasn't until 3 years, 2006, that I was able to get a job. It just didn't have a degree, didn't have experience. Again, it was the time in law enforcement where everyone wanted to be in law enforcement. It was the camaraderie was thick, it was strong, and it was very hard for you to get into that bond. And in 2006, I got on into Brevard County, local PD down there, Palm Bay. That's a not a small agency, actually a fairly large city. And it has about 170 officers. I started with them.
I think Palm Bay hosted my first training course in Florida. I think it was Palm Bay. I'm pretty sure it was Palm Bay.
I worked there for almost 8 years. And that range, getting into that range, just so you know, I wrote that $1 million grant on that range when I was in the training unit. And it went to council, got approved. It went to the governor of Florida and got approved. That range was 40 acres of just grass. Before, we would shoot on just grass on a berm, and that would be it. And I'm just proud to say I wrote that grant on that range, you know.
Awesome, dude.
Blueprints and all that. So, but I worked with Palm Bay. It was a short stint with them initially. I only worked there for about 8 months, and then I got recruited to the Orange County Sheriff's Office in Orlando. I went over there and I realized quickly that I was a, you know, very small fish in a big pond. I didn't know how to survive early on in my career in an agency that was so fast paced, so large, and the call volume was very quick. So I did about a year there, finished FTO, was on the road, and I went back to Palm Bay. Did 8 years with Palm Bay roughly, and I ended up leaving in 2014, left Palm Bay, went to a smaller agency next door, West Melbourne, was with them for about a year as well, small agency, and then ultimately ended up getting on with the Brevard County Sheriff's Office in 2016.
Why'd you go there?
I was at the point in my career where I realized I needed options. I needed to grow. I needed somewhere that I had the opportunity. And I knew deputies that started with them and they were advancing. I mean, within a year, there's so much opportunity at Brevard. You get so much opportunity if you do things the way you should. If you work hard, you get to where you want to go. And I watched people just grow beyond the efforts I felt I was putting in, and they were just moving up. And I said, that's where I got to go.
Wayne have something to do with that?
Wayne is awesome, man. Absolutely. That's the best. I say there's three sheriffs in this country that if they ran the country and they split it in three and they ran it as a sheriff of every section of the country, this country would be a better place. And that's Sheriff Ivy, Sheriff Marcino of Lee County, and Sheriff Grady Judd of Polk. Those are those guys. But Ivy is he's the man. I mean, he's the reason why I came back and got back into this.
The guy's a good fucking dude. I mean, there's a reason why we invited him to speak at our conference.
Yeah.
We are cut from the same cloth. And I got to tell you, you know, him and I, we chat, we text. He's a down to earth dude. He makes it very clear that he doesn't think he's anybody special, and he's doing really good work.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about him that is, I don't know if you know this or not, but he will stand in front of daggers for you when they're flying, when you're doing the right thing. So when his guys and girls are doing what they have to do, he stands in front of the fire and doesn't allow harm. But if you do something wrong and it can tarnish the image of the sheriff's office or law enforcement across the country, that's one place you don't want to be. I'm telling you, man. You know, if I did something, I would rather just get out and get away than be, you know, around that. So he's a great guy. He holds accountability on both sides. And that's what's important here is we have a leader who holds accountability, not just on his troops, but he holds accountability of everyone around. So if they're trying to throw daggers at you and you're not doing anything wrong, he's going to stop it. And that's what's, you know, we have the option in Brevard County. We're not afraid to do our jobs. That's the real difference. And I meet a lot of cops all over the country. I travel for work. I meet cops everywhere. I've talked to cops in Colorado, Wyoming, and Oklahoma, New Mexico. I talk to so many cops, and these guys are terrified to be proactive, you know, due to, I would say the leadership and the command.
Oh yeah.
We have no question about it. We have a great command staff, and it's not just Ivy. It's our whole command staff. All these guys, they're a team. They work well together, and it's just a great place to be. It really is.
You guys are encouraged to be proactive too, right?
Oh yeah. 100%. And when your sheriff goes out on the road himself, you know, and he's seen out there running with his hit squad, and when he's out there, how can you not be proactive? You know, when your sheriff's put people in jail.
I think it speaks to volumes leaders. Of what leadership looks like, right?
Yeah. Like I said, and when again, it goes back to not being afraid to do your job. When you look at the circumstances of what I went through, you look at a sheriff who allowed me to come back and is very much, hey, go back out there and do your job. Go back out there and put people in jail. You know, it wasn't, hey, if you come here, go hide. No, or don't come back here. It's not good for you. Whatever you want to do, if you want to apply, you're acquitted. You're welcome to apply wherever you want to go. If you come here, you come back home. You know, you're not going to find that anywhere. I put my money on it. There's not a sheriff or a chief out there that's going to bring someone back to their agency, or very slim. I might not know, very slim. That's going to come out there and say, hey, this guy has been charged before, was acquitted. That's the keyword, was acquitted, is innocent. Let's hire him. Nope. They're too worried about the noise. They're too worried about the smoke rather than doing the right thing. And that's the difference with our leader that we have.
Before I met you, he brought you up. Actually before I think you got reappointed. And he said the least I could do for that guy is give him his fucking dignity back.
Yeah.
And I'll lay the fucking in. He didn't say that, right? But he said the least I could do for that guy is give him his dignity back.
Yeah. You know, it takes a lot when you look at the circumstances about mine. And I'll just, for example, going to jail. I was in jail for a few months, almost 3 months. And the first week that I was in jail, first they ask you a questionnaire. And I said, no, I'm not suicidal. Well, you can forget that. You're going to suicide watch is pretty much what's going to happen to you. They're going to override it. So because of the scrutiny on the news and the public that was going on, and it was protests going on in my case, and then they had the warrant and it was publicized and everybody was celebrating, they put me in suicide watch. They gave me a turtle vest, which is pretty much the vest you wear. And it has nothing. It's like it's like a mini skirt, man. There's nothing. You know, you're naked, 100%. You walk into a room with deputies. They take all your clothes off. Your dignity is gone. Bend over. They check you. Put this on, and you lay in a room and you're freezing cold and you have nothing. And I said, can I get a blanket? Can I get a pillow? No, why not? You're on suicide watch. I'm not suicidal. Well, that's where the breakdown starts. Initially, when you first come in there, you're not used to it. They take your clothes, your dignity is gone. The breakdown starts. You're laying in there with nothing on. Every 15 minutes, they check on you. So they watch you. There's a camera in your room. There's a toilet and there's a camera right above it. So anything you do is monitored. But they take away everything, even a blanket, from staying warm. So you're shivering there, you're laying there, and that mental breakdown can occur. And that was a week. I was in there for an entire week without anything, you know?
Let's go back to how you ended up in that situation.
Mm-hmm. It was Father's Day 2016. I worked the night before on a midnight shift. I was actually starting a DUI on a DUI squad, new at the sheriff's office. I worked the night before. And the next day I was at my ex-wife's house. We were actually separated, but we were still cordial. So I was staying at her house and I went to go get my tire changed. It was a flat tire in my car. I went to go get it changed. And on my way back, I had an encounter on a roadway, like most people have, you know, a vehicle that almost hit my car. There was a, you know, encounter briefly right there. And I kept going. They pursued me, ultimately being two members of a blood gang from Chicago, documented in the state of Florida. They pursued me. They tried to get me to stop, try to block my car. There was multiple occasions of them getting violent with the vehicle, an attempt to actually get me to stop. And at one point, both vehicles did stop and we did get out of the car, and they attacked me, and I defended myself. And ultimately the passenger of that vehicle ended up being shot and killed. Contacted 911, relayed my information to them, and crime scene was there. Law enforcement showed up. It was at the local PD, Palm Bay. It was their jurisdiction. So you had about three agencies involved. You had Palm Bay, Brevard County Sheriff's Office, and FDLE that came in ultimately. So you had a lot of paper, a lot of witnesses involved. And so that happened. And I think it was about less than 10 days later. There was a lot of hype. I actually left the county due to the protests that were getting riled up, and information was already being swirled across the news that was false. You know, there was there was rumors that it was a love affair triangle gone bad, a drug deal gone bad. I mean, but let me tell you the worst part about this. you know this. The worst part is a lot of these rumors were being swirled by law enforcement. So it wasn't just the public. I was monitoring Facebook on a different page, and there were former cops and cops on there talking like, yeah, I worked with him and he was doing this. Like, people were just saying things that was just damaging. Right. So that happened. And yeah, less than 9 days later, they had an arrest warrant for me, and they didn't even give me the dignity of turning myself in. They told me that my cell phone was in evidence to come pick it up. I showed up, kissed my kids. Let me tell you this crazy part too, not to get off subject. No, this bothered me forever. I was asked on the phone specifically, do you have a firearm on you while you're on your way? And I said, yes, I do. I have a firearm because I'm with the sheriff's office. It's in my waistband. I wasn't told to leave my firearm in the car. I wasn't told, don't come into this building, secured building, with a firearm, right? You're going to take me in custody. You would eliminate as many threats as possible. I wasn't told nothing. Do you have a firearm? Yes. I showed up. I knocked on the door to the FDLE office. I remember hearing the bolt unlock and the door open. Now, I had no clue I was going to jail. I had no indication. I didn't do anything wrong. So I walked in. I got greeted. Hey, brother, how are you? How's everything, Whoa. Brother? Yeah. Are you feeling okay, brother? Yeah, I'm feeling. Come on, brother, right this way. Pointed to an open door and said, your phone is on that table. He walked behind me. I walked in the front. I remember I was just talking away, you know, as I was walking through that door. And as I broke the plane of that door, there was a takedown team on the other side of the wall waiting Whoa. For me. TAC vests and everything. And they just went crazy, jumping on me and screaming and, you know, police, don't move. You know, it was just chaos. And I remember one thing, and I'm telling you this, remember this. Do you have a gun on you? Yes. It's in my waistband. I flinched when I saw that group jump at me. I flinched. Had I flinched anymore, what do you think would have happened? Could have happened. I could have been killed, right? Because I got scared. The idea that you would ask me if I had a gun on me and say, hey, you're about to come into a secured building. Just do me a favor, leave your gun in the car. To me, that bothered me for a long time, because I looked at it and said, as a tactical standpoint, you know, I would have said, hey, leave your gun in the car. Don't bring it in here. But no, I had a gun on me. They got on me. They took me in custody and they pulled it straight from my waistband, pulled the gun out. And I still remember till this day, the agents were shaking when they were, you know, adjusting my handcuffs. They were sideways. They were shaking. They sat me down and a whole swarm of people came into the room in suits and tack jackets and they're on cell phones taking pictures of me. It was a swarm, and it was just like the Twilight Zone. Had no clue what was going on. And I remember an agent looking at me going, we got a warrant signed for you this morning for second degree murder and attempted murder. And I simply asked him one question without getting into detail. I said, why didn't you tell my lawyer so I can turn myself in? He said, it's nothing personal, man. It's for your safety and ours. And I said, bullshit, it ain't personal. You know, it is now.
Wow.
So, and that was the moment that I knew shit was getting real. That was the wake up call for me right there. That was the gut check and the breakdown, I say, because I did break down mentally inside to get down to a dark place I've never been in my life, to be able to swoop myself back up and to regain that strength, that frustration inside to provide me the momentum to fight back in terms of proving my innocence, you know?
So they take you down. Did they try to interview you or anything? Or you already had an attorney, right?
No, instantly, I had an attorney. I had already provided a statement with a recorded statement with my lawyer, which actually was my benefit, because that statement was critical during the trial. The statements I made corroborated what the driver of the car said. He would say things happened that corroborated my statement, and then he would change his story. But things he said lined up with mine. Like, I'll give you a brief example. They thought I had a road rage when I kept telling them I didn't do anything to the guy. He came after me and they said, well, did you slam on your brakes? It's totally legal. Did you brake check him? I said, no. Did you shoot him the bird? I said, no, my windows were too dark. They're 5%. They were rolled up. He would never see me. And they go, well, you don't know. He could have saw you. No, I never shot him the bird. Did you turn your wipers on and splash his car? No. Did you say, fuck you, man? It's totally illegal. You can do that. We're not saying you're wrong. You could have said, fuck you. Did you do that? No, I never did anything to him. He was mad about the stop sign. He came after me. So they ask him, did you see him in the car? No, his window tint was too dark. Did he ever roll down the windows? No. Did he brake check you? Swear to God. No. Did he do anything? No. So why did you follow him? I wanted to tell him, you know, he almost hit my car back there. I wanted to confront him. So it was little things like that added up ultimately during the trial, where they interviewed me and I was able to tell them my side, and little key points that just started compiling ultimately. But I get picked up, I go to Brevard County, and I spend about an hour there. I make my initial phone call to my family, break the news to them that I'm in custody. They had already got swarms of the media as breaking news. And what was really, really difficult was that I was there for, I would say maybe a couple hours, 2-3 hours, but my first appearance was lining up in the next hour and the media was already there. I don't know if this thing was planned out or what it was, but you're talking about kicking somebody when they're down.
No, it was planned. Just so you know, yeah. Dude.
Yeah.
I am telling you, I'm well aware. I'm no stranger to this game. It was planned. They all work together.
And I will tell you again, Brevard County, love that place. No complaints. Sheriff's office in the jail, no favors, but they gave me that right and said, hey man, you can waive your appearance if you don't want to go in front of those cameras. You have that right. It was kind of urgent. You know, they were letting me know you have that right not to go out there. And I said, I don't want to go out there. And I said, have a seat. And they sat me down. And my lawyer showed up 5 minutes before that appearance came. And he did the same thing, waived that right. But without a lawyer, I mean, what direction do you go? You get humiliated walking out in handcuffs, you know, and a jail suit, and you're walking around, you're scruffy, you're down, you're broken, and nobody guides you. No, these guys were giving me the bare minimum, just said, hey, you don't have to go out there if you don't want to. The media is out there. You don't have to go. And I said, I'm not going to go. But without that, I would have never known. I would have just walked out and they could have just spotlighted me, you know? So I go out there. The judge immediately does a no bond, even though I had all ties to the community, no criminal history, no bond, the circumstances, and the case was hot. So there was a lot of pressure. I get removed from there, transported on a van to Seminole County, which is the neighboring agency. And that's where I stayed for approximately the next 3 months in solitary confinement.
You went to solitary confinement?
Yeah, it was kind of weird because I was in, it's called ISO. It's kind of, Seminole County was the same place George Zimmerman was in. And I was told from inmates, oh, you're in George Zimmerman's cell. You know, I went to ISO and it's like a horseshoe. The design of this, the areas, it's like a horseshoe. So there's a door. And when they come in, all the cells are on the same side of the wall. So you can't see each other. But the officer will walk in, check on everyone, and then hit another door in the center and then come back out. So it does just like a U-turn. There's cells on the other side of the wall that they walk in. Officer would come in every hour, buzz the door. They feed you 3 times a day through the trap in the door. So you stay in your cell all day, 23 hours. You don't come outside. You stay in your cell all day, walk in circles, talk to yourself, draw, whatever you have to entertain yourself, read. And they feed you in the morning. I think it's like 4 a.m. I want to say 11 noon and 4 p.m. After 4 p.m., you get nothing. There's no more food. So you're waiting till 4 a.m. in the morning. I was fortunate, and I'll tell you this much, I'm a survivor, man. I was determined to go. When I got in there, I was determined about a week or after I broke down, rebuilt myself up, I was determined to survive, to do anything I had to do. So listening to the inmates screaming and banging on the doors all day and cussing and yelling and cussing out officers, it can take a toll on you, you know, if that's all you listen to all day. And listening to grown men cry and tell you stories how they're going back to prison. All those guys that were in those cells were bad people. I had an inmate to my left who was had charges of ag battery on the law enforcement, fleeing a lewd. He was going back to prison. The guy on my right came back from prison for writing threats to kill government officials. And he was threatening officers all day there, and he was going back to prison. The guy 2 cells down from me was sentenced 33 years for home invasion, attempted murder, and was coming back on another charge he had in the county jail. And these guys were talking to me every day. They saw me in the newspaper. They recognized my name because officers call you by your last name when they bang on the door to walk by to check on you if you're sleeping. And they recognized me and they said, hey, man, you're in the newspaper. And I denied it at first. And they said, oh, yeah, it's you. Oh, yeah, it's you. You're the cop. You got the murder charge. And I thought, what the hell? You know, so they knew it was me. But getting into survival, it's all about manipulation in jail. And I had a lot of commissary. I had a lot of money from my family. Those inmates had negative balances on their accounts. So when you're talking about what do you have in solitary, you have a hot shower and you come out one at a time. I was able to use my commissary to gain the shower first. Every time the shower came, I was able to go first, which meant I got the hottest water and I got there before any inmate was in there. Right. Of course, I wore slides on my feet, but these are the small things you got to think about. You know, I need the hot shower. It's too cold when you go in there after somebody. So I got the first shower that was hot. All the inmates would tell the officers, wake him up. You know, he needs to shower first. They would wake me up. Newspaper. The newspaper was your only connection to the outside world. There's no radio, no TV. So enabled you to actually feel alive by reading a newspaper every day, seeing the news. At the time I was in there, the Pulse nightclub shooting had just happened. So everything in the article was about Pulse, and there was updates and shootings. The six Dallas cops got shot while I was in there during the protests. And actually the inmates were celebrating when one of them announced six Dallas cops got shot, and they were actually screaming and chanting, you know. And I stood back and just listened to that, you know. It gives you an idea of the perspective of what the environment you're in, you know. So I got the newspaper first. I got to read it first. It was entertainment for an hour, you know. And if I was sleeping, the inmates told the officer same thing, give him the newspaper first. Oh, he's sleeping, slide it under his door, because they knew they wanted shampoo, Q-tips, you know, Skittles, whatever commissary I could get, books. They wanted that. And officers were kind enough to pass. I had so much sitting in my cell, I couldn't do nothing with them. They were just piled up. So I would say, hey, guys asking for Q-tips and shampoo doesn't have money. Here, can you pass this to him? Just give him Q-tips and shampoo. So it really took me through a roller coaster of emotions. And here I am now, a former deputy at the time, and I'm breaking bread, eating at the same time with inmates. We're sitting on the floor by the door and we're talking through the door as we're eating, you know, sharing war stories, you know, and not necessarily about me, but these guys are talking about their life, not seeing their kids, being in and out of jail for drugs. And I'll go even further, man. It got to the point where when I was leaving, the whole pod, they were crying. Inmates were crying. And the officer was so kind enough to bring me through there. He said, take your stuff and let's go. I said, I don't want this. He's like, you don't want your bag? I said, no, it's full of commissary. He goes, what do you want to do? I said, give it to everyone in this hallway. You know, I won't do nothing with it. And I said, can you allow me just to walk by and just say bye to everybody? If we don't see each other in person, can I just say bye? Because there's a little glass window. You don't have connection to the outside. There's no window to see outside. You're looking at a brick wall all day, all day. So there's a small window in your cell. You can see the brick wall when the officers walk by. I said, can I just go say bye? You know? Yeah. I walked over there, dabbed up the glass with my fist on it. And each one of them put their fist up and they said, you got this, man. You're going to win this, man. You shouldn't be here. You don't belong here. This place ain't for you. You know, they got the wrong one. So it's very, when I tell my story in a lot more detail to it, it's very wild, the experience to go. I had a sense of guilt when I was leaving. I felt like I was leaving people behind, honestly. And it's strange to say that, but it's the human side. You know, I knew these guys, you know, I heard some of the stories they've been through, some of the struggles they've been through and the heartaches they had in life. And I had visitation 3 days a week. These guys had zero. I would see my mom, my kids, my family, and these guys would stand by the window as I walked in and just ask me, well, what was it like? How was your mom doing? Is everybody happy? What did they say about you? Is everybody okay? Like these guys were really, it was just, it's crazy, man. Took me to a place I've never been, really, you know, and I didn't understand it. I had to lay down at nights and just sit there and wonder. And I cried sometimes, you know, not knowing what direction this was going to go, but I continued to develop myself every day to prep myself for the worst case scenario. I have to survive. I have to be able to get through this with or without my family. I got to understand my family's here today, but tomorrow they might not be able to touch me again. They might not be able to hold me. They might not be able to do anything for me. I got to be able to survive now. And I have to do it now. It's urgent. And that's where I took myself mentally when I started the development that ultimately led me into the physical ability to survive, going to the gym and working out. But changing my mindset was key when I was in jail to the development of where I'm at today.
How'd you get out?
Well, I had a bond hearing that was scheduled. I had got denied bond twice. So I was coming up on my third month and I was, you know, drawing calendars and stuff like that. And I was talking to my attorney and he came to see me and he said, hey, I have a proposal. And I said, yeah. And he told me, you have a bond hearing coming up. It's scheduled for 3 weeks out. If you want to get out now, the state attorney's office has a deal that if you put a GPS monitor on and you pay for it, they'll go ahead and agree to let you get bonded out ASAP. So of course, me, you know, realizing that the state probably knows I'm going to get a bond, but I didn't want to be in there for three more weeks. That's the control that was over you mentally. And I said, no, I'll pay for the GPS. I want to get out now. So I agreed to the bond agreement. It was about a week or so once that bond agreement went into order. We never saw a judge. Judge signed the order. GPS guy showed up once my bond was posted and it put a GPS monitor on me and I was bonded out.
Did you have to come up with a bond? Did you get a just the cost of the GPS?
Yeah, it was $60,000 was the bond, so it was 10%. And my family had already hired a bondsman, so we had all that in the works. And then the GPS was $320 a month I paid, and I paid that for almost 6 years.
What was it like to hear that you were going to be getting out?
It was unreal. I tell you, I even had a dream the day I got released. That's how I think mentally tired I was. I was sleeping and I saw in my dream, I told my parents, I saw my uncle coming to me and he was trying to wake me up. And my dad's brother, which I don't see a lot, I see him, but for some reason he was in my dream and he was knocking on my door and he's calling my name over and over and over again. And I remember waking up thinking like my uncle was calling me. And I remember waking up and looking and seeing the jail door and I'm going, where? And then my mind, I'm like, where am I? And the guy's still banging and he's like, Hafsa. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, get up. You're leaving. And I'm sitting there and I was just staring at him for like a couple seconds, you know, thinking, what are you talking? Where am I going? He's like, you got a bond, get your stuff. You're leaving. And I'm like, I'm leaving where? I'm going home. He's like, yeah, get your stuff. You're leaving, going home, you know, come out here so we can get you changed back to your clothes. And it was unbelievable. I remember coming out and instantly the first person seeing, of course, is my mom. You know, your parents will always be there for you. Seeing my mom there, and she gave me a hug, and she asked me immediately, what do you want to do? Where do you want to go? Let's just get out of here. Where do you want to go? And I said, I want to get a pizza and a soda, you know? And she took me to Pizza Hut.
I was going
to
say, even in Florida, after that, your pizza might've tasted good. Even after that, because let's face facts, Yusuf, I'm going to just jump in here and intervene.
Yeah.
I've been to Florida. Your pizza's terrible, but I can understand.
Yes, I can agree. But pizza, okay. I wasn't eating jail food. I was flushing the bologna and food down the toilet. You know, the toilet, by the way, it can flush a blanket down it. That's how strong it is. Right. And I would just take the food and we would joke around. Hey, what's for dinner today? And the officer with the trustee would be like Olive Garden, you know. And you open it up and it's a big piece of bologna with grease all over it, you know, and mashed potatoes. I take it, flip it into the toilet, flush it. And I'd get my my jail soups, you know, the ones that are famous at Walmart. Yeah, I'd get those, man. You'd eat those. Those were like, you know, fine cuisines right there until I got the pizza. But I appreciated it. Gave me a full appreciation of life. You not get carried away, but life is too good for me now. I have zero complaints. I'm still battling to see my kids. And I live life every day like it's my last. I enjoy life. I enjoy the freedom of a hot shower, a warm bed, the lights off at night. The light stayed on in our cell all day, never turned off. You know, so you'd have to guess what time it was outside. You wouldn't even know if you slept 1 hour or 12. You have no clue. So the freedoms, it's a beautiful thing to me. And now when I listen to people complain about stuff, it just gives me a different perspective because I'm like, dude, it could be worse. You know, but you got it great. But yeah, the next 5 years we're battling hearings, depositions, more.
What's that like going through? Like, what is that emotional roller coaster like?
It's traumatizing because you know the condition on me was very unique. I wasn't allowed in the county. That was my bond agreement. Not 1,000 yards. You know, there's domestic violence victims who are not allowed 1,000 yards from the suspect. The suspect's not allowed 1,000 yards from them, right? I wasn't allowed in the county that I lived in. Wasn't allowed to return. Per the bond agreement, you cannot come back here until court is over. So that put a strain on me and my kids. I wasn't allowed to attend my kids' schooling events. I wasn't allowed to go to the hospital to see them. I couldn't do any of those things without filing motions. And of course, when you're filing motions, you're getting a new docket. You're getting a new hearing. The media is on my case. So every time there's a hearing, they're showing up. You know, why put myself through that trauma every single time? Every time I went to court, the media was there. The vans were there. You know, it was like a tactical approach. You got to figure out what direction to come in from because they're shoving cameras in your face. They're immediately following you. And then you got to think about the family of the other side. Every time there was a hearing, the families would show up. And at one point, before the security got tight, there was a near confrontation that occurred when I was walking out with my legal team, minding my business, and they confronted and tried to fight. You know, and here I am, like my lawyer's telling me, don't do nothing, stay back, trying to stop me at all costs. I'm like, dude, you know, I got to defend myself here, but we need something to happen. Like this can't happen. You know, this just can't be okay to take place and allow this to happen. And I'm backed into a corner where I have to, you know, put socks over my hands and tie my hands behind my back and allow whatever's going to happen take place because you have a pending case. You can't, It's like, well, then I need to be protected. This is what's going to happen. So I really didn't want to go to court at all, you know, unless it was urgent. So I didn't really fight any of the motions. I just went along, and my lawyers did a lot of the hearings without me, ultimately till we started the Stand Your Ground hearing and then the trial.
Father, how many kids do you have?
I have three. I have two from a former, and I have a 8-month-old daughter now.
So you had two kids, right? I'm a father.
Yeah.
Can't imagine what that must have been like, torturous wise.
Yeah, my kids talked to me on the phone, and my oldest daughter knew what was going on, and having that conversation with her of her fears, that's a real conversation I had with my daughter. At one point, she brought it up, and she didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I used to see my kids in jail when they used to come see me, and they would ask me from behind a glass window, and we would touch our hands on the glass and talk on the phone. And they would say, "Dad, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing here?" They didn't know I was in jail. They were too young. I said, "I'm painting." And they go, "What are you painting?" I go, "I'm painting the whole building." They go, "Well, how long is it going to take you? When are you coming back?" I said, "When I finish painting, it's going to be a while, but I got to keep painting, Dad. Once I finish painting, I'm coming home." "Okay." You know, these are all the things at one point was very difficult for me. And I'm going to tell you something, Dennis, it sounds very crazy, but at a point in my life, nothing mattered anymore. In terms of my family, my kids, nothing mattered anymore other than my survival. If I didn't survive getting through this case and didn't survive, it wouldn't matter to me. The love I had for my kids and my family was too emotional. It was too much of a connection for me that was breaking my ability to focus on surviving. So I understood that they were there. I love my kids. I love my mom, but I was prepared to survive without them because that was the reality and I was coming. And I looked at my family and I said, you know, looked at my lawyer, what's the possibilities? There's a possibility. We don't know, 50-50 with a jury. You could go to prison. So that possibility was on the table. And I looked at my family and I said, these are the conditions. You guys take care of my kids. Whatever happens, take care of my kids. But, you know, I'm going to do my own survival, which means I'm going to, you know, not be so attached in a lot of realms because I have to be able to live outside of the world that's not, you know, free. When you're not free, you're not free. And those little things really eat you alive. When you talk on the phone, talk to your family, they tell you, "Yeah, hey, we're going to the store. We're going here, going there." There's just such an emotional connection that it just hurts inside when you're not able to be part of that. When you hear those things, you know, you hear your kids' voices. So I went through a lot of different perspectives, and nobody taught me how to survive this. I had to go through it on my own. And I knew, like I said, ultimately it was self-affirmation, realizing that, you know, I didn't have law enforcement anymore. I didn't have the attaboys from the squad. I didn't have those deputy officer of the month. I wasn't recognized anymore. I was kind of disowned, you know, at least the feelings of abandonment, the feelings of being disowned and not no longer welcome, part of the family, you know, you're out now. And now because that happened, I had lost a lot of my friends, a lot of the law enforcement community weren't communicating to me anymore because I had felony pending cases. So now you're out on your own. You got to fend for yourself. And that's the reality. And that's what I talk about when I say I had to dig deep and survive. I had to know that I had to do this on my own. Nobody could do nothing for me anymore. I didn't have friends. This is a survival, do or die.
Did anybody, even one person, reach out to check in on you?
Yeah, I did. I had some jail letters, honestly, from officers, which I was surprised that were willing to put their job on the line. They wrote me in jail. And it was pretty emotional letters, man. I could read the breakdown in their letters, you know, telling me that they're distraught. And one thing about it, Dennis, is I was fairly confident and competent in my job that I did. And I say that because I didn't have a lot of issues in my career. I didn't have write-ups in 11 years. I wasn't an IAs. I didn't have that problem. And to see officers write me saying, "If this can happen to you, I'm terrified. You know, what can happen to me? I don't know how I would live." Like, that's the letters I was getting from officers saying, if you're going through this and you have a great reputation, if you're able to go through this and they can do this to you, I'm scared because I don't have the same confidence you have. I don't have the same friends you have, you know, in law enforcement. So that's some of the things that I got. And I did have a small circle of law enforcement that stuck with me during the trials, but were silent about it, you know. But for the most part, majority of them were gone. And when I got that acquittal, my phone blew up. They were coming out the woodworks, man, left and right. And I wasn't bitter about it. Once I was acquitted, man, my whole life changed. You know, my perspective on life changed. The small things didn't matter anymore. The little bit bickering and disputes no longer mattered. Ego is not even a factor for me. Doesn't exist in my world. It was crushed long ago. You know, so now I just take life every single day without it.
prior to the trial unfolding, and I guess 5 or 6 years later, which is wild, were they offering you plea agreements?
No, they didn't offer plea agreements because I think they were listening to my jail calls, where I was very adamant in the jail calls and to my lawyer that I would not even entertain a plea deal. So don't even bring it to me. I said, it's not going to happen. I'll go to prison for life and accept that through a trial before I accept a plea deal. I didn't do anything wrong. I said that the fact that you can attack someone in the state of Florida and be tried and convicted, I said, I'm willing to take that, but I will never accept laying down. I did not do anything to those guys. They came after me and there's zero accountability coming towards them. Zero accountability for the guy who started the whole thing that caused the death of his friend. I was prepared for prison, man. I was training MMA. I was in the gym. I got arrested at 135 pounds. And when I was out of jail about 3-4 months, I was 180. I was working out. People were looking at me going, what are you doing? What are you eating? What are you taking? And I said, nothing. Can you imagine somebody working out going, hey, what's your gym workout? And I said, I'm prepared. I'm working out for prison. And they go, what do you mean? I said, I might go to prison and I have to be ready. I'm not losing any scenario I go into. I'm surviving. I'm not walking in frail with my head down. I'm not doing that. I said, I'm walking in. Every scenario I face, I'm going to overcome. And they put me with my back against the wall. Shame on me if I did not prepare myself in the next 5 years for what was coming next. So I had to get myself to that level. And it worked out. Ultimately, I was prepared for the worst, but I was still focused, knowing in my heart, and you ask my lawyer, I always said, I'm going to walk out this. It's going to be not guilty. The trial, they cannot escape the evidence. They can scrutinize me all over the media. They can never escape the evidence. And it didn't line up. And I'll tell you about the jury. It's crazy to pick a jury. You're doing an interview of a bunch of people who walk in and they're looking at you and it's like an introduction. This is the defendant. He's charged with this, you know, and you're waving at them and smiling, you know. It was unreal to me. These people are sitting there and these are we the people of your peers. Coming in and you're asking them questions, you're doing an interview and people are telling you straight up, I don't like the police. I won't support it. Okay. They're removed. And people saying, I don't have a problem with the police, but I do believe, you know, I can be fair. I think they get a lot of negative publicity and they're not really, you know, so you get both sides. And when the verdict was read, and I'll tell you this, to get to this part, my lawyer looked at me, we were talking. He said, just to give you an idea, if the jurors come out, they don't look at you, it's typically a guilty verdict. And if they do look at you, it's a not guilty. So I thought, okay. And the verdict was in. It was 5-day jury trial, a 4.5-hour deliberation. And then the verdict was read at 9:30 at night, roughly. So we had to sit in the courtroom. The judge said, even if it takes till 2:30 in the morning, we're not leaving. So I was going to get remanded to jail immediately if it was a guilty verdict.
What's that like, sitting there? Holy shit.
Well, the family ordered food and everybody was sitting in the hallway. They closed the courthouse down and I couldn't eat. I couldn't eat because my life was, you know, it was a death sentence, man. Ultimately, 25 years to life. I was facing life in prison for murder, minimum mandatory with a firearm, and 25 years on attempted murder. And the scrutiny that I was catching left and right from the media, I knew I was going to catch a maximum sentence. So, so that was my last chance really for survival. Ultimately, and I was just clinging on to the will of that. I had a little bit of light inside of me left, hanging on to. But I wasn't out yet. And the verdict came in, and yeah, it was very nerve-wracking. I could feel my pulse in my neck, you know, pretty much hitting hard. A little difficult to breathe when you try to control yourself. But the verdict came in, jurors walked out, and none of them looked at me. You know,
they didn't look at you?
They didn't look at me. They all looked
down.
Oh,
my God.
So you're talking about the tremors inside of me were just really going. I dropped my head down, closed my eyes, and I, you know, just began to pray. You know, began to pray for the best scenario. It was unreal. It's very tough thinking about it. And I remember the jury handing the paperwork to the judge, and the judge sifting through it, and it feels like a lifetime of eternity, you know, of him reading through that paperwork, and you're just wanting to know, you know. And then you watch those deputies swarm the courtroom, preparing for the verdict, and then guys I used to work with standing behind me to take me in custody, you know, so they're blocking my path behind me and on the side. And it's just it's a reality check, man. It's something you can never describe. So it's a death sentence. Ultimately, you're walking to the chamber, and they handed the paper to the clerk. And I believe my understanding was she was like a week or two on the job. So they handed her the paper, and I remember her hand shaking, you know, while she's holding the paper. And she's staring at it for a couple of seconds. She's not reading the verdict, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, oh my God. And I had my eyes closed, and she read count one, second degree murder. We the jury find a defendant not guilty. And I closed my eyes even harder because I had a second charge of attempted murder, which was 25 years. And I waited for that verdict. She read that second count. We, the jury, find a defendant attempted murder not guilty. The manslaughter was instantly off the case because once there's a not guilty verdict on both counts, manslaughter is removed. So the manslaughter charge was on there, which was an option on regarding the guilty charges. If they were going to find me guilty, they could find me guilty of manslaughter. They found me not guilty on all counts.
What was that feeling like, dude, when you heard that?
I can't describe it. I thought the best feeling in my life was going to the academy the day I got accepted. And then the day I got my first job in law enforcement, I was so overwhelmed with joy. I thought that was the best day of my life. I pinned it. And then the best day of my life was when I had my first daughter. You know, this is the best day. And then the best day of my life was my second daughter. And then getting arrested and then feeling that feeling of the best day of my life ultimately was hearing the not guilty verdict. Ultimately.
How old are your kids now?
They're 12 and 10.
They're young.
Yeah, they're young. Yeah, they were young when it was going on. They're very well aware of it. My daughters were happy and celebrated when it was over, you know, so they did see me immediately when it was over. But when you're talking about the compound of, you know, hardship and heartache that, you know, I faced through all of it, I don't know who else would have went through that and survived it.
So, you know, you're acquitted. When did you start revisiting the idea of returning to law enforcement?
I waited about 6 months. I was, my family owns a successful garage door business in 18 states. So I've been doing that. I waited about 6 months. When I tried to go back, they told me my law enforcement cert was expired because I went over 4 years. They thought I wasn't going to go to the academy and get it back. And I did. I went back to the academy. I took a 2-week course. I got my cert back, got recertified, did everything on my own, and then applied back at BCSO. And they took me back. They put me through the regular hiring process like everyone else. That's the beauty of my sheriff. They scrutinize him. He's a very honest guy. He hired me through all the same backgrounds, polygraph, you know, every examination that they do for a new hire. I did it, passed everything, got back on board, but I decided to stay a reserve, not full time.
Still doing the garage door thing, doing reserve deputy sheriff work.
Yeah, I dedicate some time. Why the decision? I wanted to get my dignity back. I felt like it was my story to write in my life. My life is everyone has a book. And you write your book and you close your chapters when you decide to do it. No one, I don't decide Dennis's story. And no one was going to decide my story. They weren't going to take my career of 11 years of honor, integrity that I committed to my community, of things that were done behind closed doors no one knows about that I dedicated to the community. I wasn't going to allow them to slander me and defame me and throw me under the bus like that. And then I walk away and they go just right off in the sunset. Wasn't going to happen. And if I allowed them to do that, this would be the norm like it's been. My story hopefully will allow other officers to understand the circumstances they go through might not be as severe, but you can take back your job. You can go back and it can be, it's your story. Don't allow them to dictate where you go. Go back. Even against the odds, go back. And that's why I did that.
And the last thing we want to talk a little about is the identity crisis of making your life ingrained as a law enforcement officer. Your whole identity is around the thin blue line, but tell people how that affected you.
Well, the first thing that happened to me when that job separated is the emotions of being abandoned, feeling not welcome, adopt a child. You're now moved on to somewhere else. You're not allowed here. I was so ingrained in law enforcement. It was everything about law enforcement that when it was taken from me and I hit the civilian world, I didn't know where to go. I was lost. I was confused. The only thing that came up to my mind really was, do I go work security somewhere? You can't do that. And that's what I learned, separating yourself from the identity of law enforcement. I'm Deputy Hafsa when I go to the Brevard County Sheriff's Office. I'm not a deputy when I leave. Okay, I'm off duty, but I'm Yusuf. I have an identity. I go to basketball games. I fly to different states. I travel. I hike. I play sports. That is my life. I take care of my kids and I take care of my family. Law enforcement is not my, I don't wear thin blue line stuff outside. I don't have bumper stickers on my car. I don't identify my house as law enforcement. I don't do any of that, okay? Because that's not my life. That's a job that I'm passionate about when I'm there. But when I leave there, it doesn't run my life. It's not who I am. I don't walk around as the enforcer when I'm off duty. You know, I'm a civilian. I'm a person. I'm a human with the fellow humans around me. But I happen to have a little bit more skill and training in some areas, and I'm a little bit more alert. But again, I'm not attached to it to the hip that if I lose it, I don't know how to function. if law enforcement was taken to me tomorrow again, or I decide to walk out, there's no hard feelings. I won't lose any sleep. It's totally fine. It's an opportunity I had. It's a job they gave me that I was qualified for, but they accepted me in that job. They can take it away the same way. And I think if law enforcement officers understand that, that you're not, you know, these things aren't given to you because, you know, you deserve it. You have to have it. Okay. It's just a job.
One last thing, and I'll ask you to try to tailor it to being a little more survival. What would you say to somebody going through a very, very difficult, challenging time in their life?
I would say if you're going through something challenging in your life, understand the first thing is to love yourself. And that might sound like a weird statement. You have to love yourself and forget about what everyone else is saying about you. Don't worry about what people are saying. Don't worry about your coworkers, especially in law enforcement. Eliminate them. Self-affirmation. That's been the biggest key. Surviving, living alone. We survive and we train to survive ambushes. We train to sit with our back against the wall. You need to learn how to live on your own, be your own person. And when you're going through some hardship, get through that battle on your own. But fight to live every day. Don't punch your ticket. Fight to live. Even if there's a speck of light left, just keep fighting, just like I did. And it turned out in my favor.
Listen, dude, you know, I don't know much more about, you know, everything that went on, but I'm very sorry that it had to happen to you in the way that it did. I'm glad you've seen a positive side of it. And I appreciate you taking the time today to come here and do this with us and tell your story. And I think it'll provide a lot of value for folks. You know, hopefully that you continue on to see the better parts of your life. And I'm sorry that you had to experience that. But
I appreciate
you, brother. And whatever I could say at this time is, you know, that it's impressive. And certainly what I want to do is wish you a happy holidays. Thank you for being here today, my friend. It's a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you. And just anytime you want me back, just let me know. I appreciate you guys. Thank you for having me.
I will, brother. I'll see you, man. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care, bro.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.